The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
The thing about the obstruction section of the report is that the greatest hits of obstruction all come after Mueller was appointed. The attempt to fire Mueller, Trump's attempt to get McGahn to create a false document to basically recant on what he had told Mueller's prosecutors. The best meatiest part of it come from after Mueller's appointed. And in that time is when they had McGahn. And it's an astounding level of cooperation.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 14th, 2020. Michael S. Schmidt is a reporter for the New York Times, a reporter who broke a number of key stories during the Russia investigation. He is, most recently, the author of Donald Trump versus the United States, Inside the Struggle to Stop a President, a new book with exhaustive reporting on the history of the Russia investigation and the confrontation between the president and those in his administration who tried to put the brakes on his most extreme behaviors. Schmidt joined me in the virtual jungle studio to talk about the book. We talked about Jim Comey and his wife, Patrice. We talked about former White House counsel Don McGahn and the impossible situation he was in, being a deep believer in the Trump agenda and also an informant for the Mueller investigation. And we talked about the Mueller investigation, why it never answered those counterintelligence questions everyone was expecting it to address. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 14th, Mike Schmidt on Stopping a President. So, Mike, I want to start with the question of why the world needs another book about the Russia investigation, Trump, and Jim Comey and Bob Mueller. What is the ground that you're covering here that hasn't already been well trodden by a lot of other people?
It's a great question. That was one of the great challenges of the book, was figuring out, how do you say something lasting and how do you say something different and impactful at the same time that tells a larger story that holds together? And more that I looked at this issue, the more and more that I saw that there was a phenomenon going on here that I thought was different than anything we had seen before. I think that for much of American history, we focused on how presidents use their power. What does that say about the president? What does that say about the moment? What does that say about the country, what the country is confronting at that time? And how did the people around the president help the president do that? In the case of Trump, something very different was happening, I thought. I thought the people around the president who were supposed to be there to help the president achieve his agenda, we're trying to stop him. And it's not just like trying to stop someone. It's trying to stop the most powerful person in the world. And from a human perspective, I thought that was fascinating. And from a historical perspective, I thought I should try and capture what that is like. What is it like to stand toe-to-toe with the president and try and stop the president from doing something? If you're the 911 operator, and you take the call. There's no other 911 operator to call. If you're the FBI director, there's no other FBI director to call. If you're the White House counsel, there's no other White House counsel to call. So what is it like when you're truly the last line of defense?
So, Mike, you've structured the book very self-consciously in Shakespearean terms. The book begins with a quotation from King Lear, and then the table of contents is structured as a four-act tragedy. So why did you organize the book that way? And to what extent do you see this as a kind of Shakespearean tragedy?
I certainly see it as a saga. And I think that the human sort of carnage of it has not been totally captured. And I was trying to capture that human element of what this experience has been like. And if you look at the saga, I think, I don't know if I would use the word Shakespearean because I think that's too lofty, but there are some really interesting story developments and things that encompass this. And if you start at the most basic level, Jim Comey knew that there was something off about the fact that truth was not holding the way that it was in the country. He could see that there was something changing in the world around him after he became FBI director and was back at the perch atop government. And he believed that that change was so significant and drastic that he needed to hold a press conference to basically set this on the right path, because the public and the institutions of Washington would not be able to level set it on their own. And as he goes in to do that, to hold that press conference, he in some ways sets himself on a path that leads to him ultimately seeing his worst nightmare scenario of what happens to the reputation of the FBI and the Justice Department and the end of his tenure in the FBI. And I think if you're starting from that vantage point and seeing how Comey recognized this and went in to try and do something and ultimately was blamed essentially for doing that and had to confront someone in Donald Trump as president who was and is a worst nightmare scenario for Comey, I just thought that saga is remarkable.
You could start a book like this on the beginning of the campaign. You could start the book the day of the inauguration, the beginning of the confrontation between Trump and the FBI. What is the narrative scope that you're covering here?
So the place that I wanted to, in the timeline, start this story was on September 11th of 2012. And that is the day of the Benghazi attacks. And I deal with what I'm about to lay out in the book, but I don't start the book there. But let me explain why that day is so important. On that day, Mitt Romney promises not to attack Obama as they're running against each other for president, because it's 9/11 and you don't attack each other on 9/11 on such a sacred day. By that night, Romney is putting out a statement that essentially accuses Obama of being on the side of the terrorists. And Romney is dipping his hand into the far reaches of the right and the conspiratorial part of the right that is really crossing a threshold for him. And what happens is that event, that decision by Romney, sets off so many questions about Benghazi. And he's using the imprimatur of being the Republican nominee to do this, sets off all these questions, that the questions about Benghazi kick around and kick around and kick around, and the Obama administration in the year and a half that follows can't get rid of them. And enough pressure is ultimately put on John Boehner to appoint a special committee to investigate the Benghazi attacks. Trey Gowdy, the head of that committee, has his investigators go to the State Department and say, okay, we're doing this big Benghazi investigation. What do you got? And they say, we've got a stack of 10,000 documents that the people at the State Department thought they were never going to have to produce because they had the thorniest issues of executive privilege, classified, et cetera. And they say, we'll take those documents first. And when they receive those documents, they see 8 emails from Hillary Clinton. And at that point, the committee has Hillary Clinton's personal emails, and you're on the pathway to disclosure about her email account and everything that comes after it in the 2016 election.
You look at this story through the lens of the people, as you say, who were trying to stop the president, which is a very odd posture for an executive branch official to be in, a little bit less odd for a congressional figure. But, you know, as you say, the general position of the executive branch is that they are arms of the president. They are trying to carry out the president's agenda, fulfill the president's policies. And yet you focus on a number of people, particularly the White House counsel, Don McGahn, and the FBI director, Jim Comey, and then ultimately, of course, Bob Mueller, you know, who are in a much more adversarial posture with respect to trying to prevent the president from essentially from being himself. So talk to me about the psychology of that, and particularly with respect to Don McGahn, who's a pretty central figure in the book. You don't go to the White House to try to stop the president. How did Don McGahn end up in this position?
So the thing about McGahn that I think McGahn's the most remarkable character of the Trump era, and for three basic, hugely consequential reasons. He's in charge of the umbilical cord between Trump and his base, the judges. He's remaking the federal judiciary, not just with typical Republican judges, but a very certain type of conservative judge and a fairly young one at that. And he's remaking the federal judiciary. And that tether, I think, allowed Trump to behave the way that he did without the base running away from him. The second thing is that he's, as we've been talking about, a chief container of Trump. He's stopping Trump from hurting himself, hurting the country, hurting the institution of the presidency. Just a highly unusual thing for a White House counsel to be trying to stop a president. And the third thing about McGahn is that he's caught up as the chief witness, as a lawyer, against his client. And despite all this, he's staying in his job because he thinks he can hear in Kennedy's voice that Kennedy may retire. And if Kennedy retires, then McGahn will have another shot at filling someone on the court. But McGahn believes if he leaves, Kennedy may not retire because he won't trust who will come after him. So McGahn has these incredible forces on him, and he's staying in the ring basically to remake the federal judiciary. He's come to the Trump trough, and he's going to walk away with a remade judiciary. So what was he willing to put up with to do that? He realized that he could only contain so much of Trump, but he was going to stay for his own political gain and because he believes so much in the judges. And that's just a remarkable thing to go on for someone in a White House, where in the past, a White House counsel would be there to, you know, make sure they're, I'm not diminishing the role of the White House counsel, but it would be a much more straightforward job of, you know, determining what the president can or can't do, and the president largely listening to the White House counsel and them carrying out the president's agenda. And it's just the fact that Trump just turns all of that on its head that allows this highly unusual situation to develop with his lawyer, with the lawyer for the White House.
And yet in your account, I mean, the extent of that is extraordinary. McGahn becomes effectively a real-time confidential informant for the Mueller investigation. So Lawfare podcast listeners, some of them will be very sophisticated about the reason as why this happened, which was these rulings in appellate courts in the D.C. Circuit and Eighth Circuit from the Clinton era, which held that there is no government attorney-client privilege, right? And so his relationship with Trump isn't privileged. How do we go from that to Mueller's people effectively tasking McGahn to find things out for them and report back?
So although there's that decision, if you have a White House counsel in a high-profile investigation like this, usually the person at the White House dealing with that investigator puts constraints on what that lawyer, what that White House counsel can say and do, because it's such an invasive thing to have the president's lawyer as an open book. But what happened was, is that Trump had been sold by his lawyers, Ty Cobb and John Dowd, and a strategy of cooperating. And they were going to cooperate with Mueller, but they never took the time to figure out what the witnesses may know or say. So they never figured out what McGahn knew. So they told him to go in and cooperate. And McGahn and his lawyer, Bill Burke, are thinking, they don't know what we know. And they want us to go in and be an open book. And they're not going to put constraints on it. And they're not going to find out what McGahn may know, so the president could try and assert some sort of privilege. Even if that privilege doesn't hold, like in the courts, McGahn thought that they should go to court to fight over it. It would drag it out. But even if that didn't hold, you can reach a negotiation. That fact is proven because by the time that Cobb is gone, over a year later, and John Kelly, the White House chief of staff, goes in, Emmett Flood, the top lawyer who's dealing with the special counsel at that point, says, you can have Kelly. You can have him for 2 hours. At that point, McGahn had spent 30 hours with Mueller's team. And what happens is that McGahn, realizing that he has to go in, he's being told by the White House to cooperate. If he's going to cooperate, he has to fully cooperate. And to protect himself, was going to be the first person to tell the special counsel's office anything, because this was not a normal criminal investigation. This was an investigation that was going to end with a report. And an errant adjective or verb here or there could have destroyed McGahn's reputation. And McGahn has to preserve who he's going to be, because he has a whole, he's mid-career. He's in his 40s. So when he goes in to cooperate, he's, and Bill Burke are going to make sure that they, Mueller's team, hears from them first. And it creates this thing. And Cobb is not policing the relationship between the special counsel's office and McGahn and Burke. And he doesn't understand how close and intimate it becomes.
So you've made this point elsewhere, but I think it's a point that for our listenership is really worth dwelling on. This sounds to me like frank malpractice on the part of the president's personal lawyers. And I'm not asking you to comment on their performance, but I just want to flesh out some of the facts as you've described them. Number one, that they allowed McGahn to spend 30 hours with Mueller's people without really finding out what he knew. Number two, that their idea of cooperation involved basically telling him, go ahead and answer whatever questions, and putting no conditions or restrictions on it, and not negotiating for terms that would limit. And third, therefore, kind of being unaware as this relationship becomes intimate and almost tasking. And in your description, as McGahn acquires a very powerful incentive to be the first to report things that Mueller's people might eventually learn about, and so becomes sort of proactively forthcoming. I want to suggest that that is absolutely terrible lawyering on the part of the president's personal counsel. If you don't want to address the terrible lawyering question.
So I've talked to people around the president that are very close to the president who understand what went on here, and they think it's malpractice. I'm not sure the president appreciates it, but they think that this was highly reckless. And the only reason that it does not have a greater consequence is that the president ultimately skates on the obstruction issue. We know more about Donald Trump's attempts to obstruct justice because of the Mueller report than, like, certainly, I mean, it's astounding how much we know, and it's all because of McGahn. But because Trump faces no consequence because of that, because Mueller declines to make a decision, and the president's not impeached over it, it becomes less significant. But every lawyer that I talk to about this, and I every single lawyer that I came in contact with in this story, I would ask about this because I found it so remarkable. And no one thought that this was a good idea.
And I agree with you that the president didn't really face severe consequences for this, except one, which is the text of Volume 2 of the Mueller report, right? And to the extent that the president has, you know, a 200-page document outlining his 10 or 8 or, depending on how you count, 11 instances of possible obstructive activity, that is largely a function, not entirely a function, of the extent and degree of McGahn's cooperation, right?
It's also I'm just saying, like, on the broad brushstrokes, the president faced no consequences. I'm talking about sort of legally and impeachment wise. Obviously, politically, it was damaging to him, but he's been damaged so badly politically that it's hard to measure what the impact of it was. But the thing about the obstruction section of the report that is even more remarkable is that the greatest hits of obstruction all come after Mueller was appointed. The attempt to fire Mueller, Trump's attempt to get McGahn to create a false document to basically recant on what he had told Mueller's prosecutors. The best meatiest part of it come from after Mueller's appointed. And in that time is when they had McGahn. And it's an astounding level of cooperation because, I mean, I'm sure you're prosecutor listeners may know this or have a better articulated way of saying this, but with a witness, you want someone who's truthful, has a good command of the facts, has a good memory, documents the stuff, and also has great proximity. And McGahn checked all those boxes. It's a dream witness, to the point that by the spring of 2018, Mueller's team is going back to Bill Burke and saying, well, is Trump talking about, you know, prosecuting Comey? Is Trump had a role in getting rid of McCabe? They're looking to see whether Trump is continuing to obstruct justice and trying to use the power of his presidency to punish potential witnesses, Comey and McCabe. And to me, that's just like off the charts remarkable.
It is off the charts remarkable. Talk about McGahn's own psychological experience of this. So on the one hand, you describe him being a real true believer in the Trump agenda, or even really it's McGahn's agenda that, you know, I'm sure McGahn felt more strongly about it than Trump did. On the other hand, he's informing on Trump in real time on obstruction stuff to the special counsel's office, and he has apparent bewilderment at the conduct of the president's lawyers, and he's witness to some genuinely remarkable activity, including stuff that he's sufficiently worried about that he, you know, in order to fire Mueller, that he refuses to participate in. And then he finally leaves, having been sort of dismissed, agreeing to hang on until after the Kavanaugh nomination. He leaves having been the subject of some Trump ridicule, although not nearly as bad as some others face. How does Don McGahn feel about the experience at the end of the day?
I think McGahn is a very, very conflicted person. He wanted to remake the courts. He knew he had a once and a never again opportunity to do that. And he basically is willing to put up with a lot of stuff that is on the line questionable to do that. And in that process, I think he's conflicted. I think he believes in Trumpism more than Trump does. He believed that the Republican Party did not need to follow the 2012 autopsy, it needed to run to the far right, that it needed to tap in to that far base, that it needed to go after those Americans who thought they had been left behind by trade deals. And that was a core belief of his, and he was a true believer in that. And McGahn also has a bit of a renegade streak in him, where he was never going to be offended by Trump's behavior. McGahn's a guy who went to the FEC, and as Bob Bauer said to me, was the most consequential head of the FEC because he ground the place to a complete halt. He's like a true believer in limiting government power. And he wasn't offended by Trump's behavior. And he kind of liked the idea that they were going to come in and smash things. McGahn thinks the federal government has overreached mightily. So he comes to this, and because Trump is so unusual, he empowers McGahn to basically be a committee of one to nominate the judges. This is not going to be a process like in past White Houses where they sit around with resumes and they talk to the Justice Department and they look at, you know, lawyers and their history and stuff like that. McGahn streamlined this. He's going to go find these young lawyers that have a certain type of belief, a very conservative belief, a similar belief to a Thomas or a Gorsuch or a Scalia, and they are going to pump them through to McConnell, and McConnell's going to ram them through the Senate, and they are going to fill all of these posts and remake the courts to come. There's a reason why I focused on Comey and McGahn. We're going to be living in Don McGahn's America for decades and decades to come. I also think there's a very good argument that if you're a Democrat or Republican, you would say we live in the world that Jim Comey had an enormous impact on. Besides Obama and Trump, I think you make a good argument that a lot of what we live with today is tied back to decisions that Comey made. And not only are these people, their human experiences intriguing of what is it like to stop a president, but I believe they're historically consequential.
So let's talk about that. You make a very interesting choice in the portrayal of Jim Comey to do it to a large extent through the eyes of Patrice Comey, Jim's wife. Tell us about that decision and why Patrice Comey is an interesting figure for you.
So Comey presented for storytelling purposes, and I don't think of myself as a storyteller. I think of myself as a newspaper reporter who tried to tell a story in the book, but Comey presented a very unique challenge. Comey has written a book, testified before Congress, he's gone on national television. Democrats have largely made up their mind what they think about him. Republicans have made up their mind what they think about him. And in that sense, we've all kind of looked at Comey and made up our minds. So how do you tell the Comey story in a way that's new and different? How do you bring that story to life in a way? Because he, I believe, is a historically hugely consequential person in the decision he makes, whether it's, you know, the stuff that goes on with keeping the memos about Trump or the email investigation, things that we all know. So the editors that I was talking to about the book says, well, you got to write about Comey. You probably have covered Comey more than anyone else, and you hypothetically understand him better than anyone else. So, you know, and you wrote about his memos and were caught up in all that. So you got to write about Comey. I don't want to write about Comey. And I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. And I thought, we need to try and find a different way at looking at Comey. We're sort of all looking at him at a 45 degree angle. Let's see if we can move the camera. Let's see if we can move the lens and come at him from a different way. And I thought, you and I will never be the FBI director. And it's very hard to relate to that. We're never going to have to be in that type of position and have to make the decisions he did. But if we look at Comey through the eyes of a loved one, like his wife, we can relate a little bit more to that, because we all know what it's like to watch a loved one go through something excruciating and feel paralyzed by that and feel awful for the person we love going through that. And my sense was, is that if we could tell Comey through the eyes of Patrice, we may understand Comey better. And it may be a new and fresh way of illuminating him, because I think the more we can understand about him, the more that we have a better historical context of what he did. So I sat down with Patrice Comey and I said, I can't imagine what it's been like to be you and to have watched this and experienced this. And I just kind of shut up and I tried to listen to her story. And I found it fascinating because she took me into these moments before the press conference, before the October reopening of the investigation, election night, where she has to tell Comey that Trump has won, and watching Comey then, when Trump becomes president, struggle to contain him. And I said, okay, this is a new and different way to tell this story. And she's a very compelling character, and she has a very interesting history herself. And she's also a bit of a partisan in the sense that she really wanted Hillary Clinton to win. And here was her husband being blamed for getting Donald Trump, someone she thought was an existential threat to the country, and someone who she knew her husband would think absolutely little of. And let's try and tell that story. And that's what I tried to do.
And how does the story seen through the eyes of Patrice change a reasonable assessment of Jim Comey, or does it?
I don't know. And that I'm going to leave up to the reader to try and see how much that changes their understanding of him or not. But I think what it allows you to do, it allows you to see a little bit better what Comey was seeing, because you see him trying to explain to her why he's holding the press conference and why he's reopening the investigation. She's essentially pushing back on him and saying press conferences could be really bad for you. And in October, she's thinking, holy shit, this could get Donald Trump elected president. You can't do this so close to an election. And Comey is forced to defend his decision. And I think in looking through her eyes, Comey is a little bit easier to listen to, because I think that a lot of people tune Comey out when he's on book tour trying to explain this, because people have sort of made up their mind about how they view him and how they view the decisions he's made. And I thought that watching him defend this as he's making these decisions to his wife illuminated them in a way that me, someone who had studied these decisions, understood better. You got to leave it up to the public to figure out whether they think it's right or wrong. And people have very strong views about what he did. And my guess is a lot of people will not be swayed by it. And it wasn't my job to sway the reader one way or another. But I thought, okay, here's this guy who had this enormous impact. And now we get to see him from a different angle and a different vantage point and maybe understand him better. And I thought that if I could do that, it also shows the human element here, which I tried to come back to, which was like, what was it like to be laying in bed on election night? Comey goes to bed. Florida has just been called for Trump. He thinks that the blue wall will prevent Hillary Clinton. He goes to bed and he thinks Hillary Clinton's going to be elected president. And around, I think, 4 or 5 o'clock, 3, 4, somewhere in the morning, Patrice comes in and wakes him up and says, Donald Trump's been elected president. And she's been crying on the phone with her daughters. And what is that like to all of a sudden think that you may have helped get Donald Trump elected president when you're laying there in bed, staring up at the ceiling and your wife's just woken you up? I said, that's just incredibly dramatic.
It's incredibly dramatic. And I've known Jim for a long time, and I talked to him in the period after this, and I have always been fascinated by the question of what his emotional reaction was to the possibility that he had played a role in Trump's election. I'm curious, after this amazing quantity of reporting, including the time that you've spent with Patrice, how do you understand his emotional response to, certainly it's something he never meant to do, right? He has said he's faintly nauseous at the possibility that the FBI played any role in influencing any aspect of the election. What do you think is his internal monologue about the question of his own role in possibly helping Trump be elected?
As I write in the book, he starts sort of rationalizing to himself. We didn't do this. Did we do this? We didn't do this. Oh, maybe he won't be so bad. The office will change him. Maybe I can be someone that steers the president in the right direction. These are just business people. They just need to be guided a little bit. It won't be so bad. He starts rationalizing things to him. I think a lot of people said to themselves, but it just hits home to him in a way that is different because he's been so closely associated with what happened just days before in opening the investigation. So he rationalizes it to himself. And I think Patrice did that too. The office was going to change him. And oh my God, we didn't do this. Did we do this? And he's wrestling with these questions in his head. And he's trying to do, I think, what anyone in that situation would do is say, well, maybe, it couldn't have been that, you know, couldn't have been us. Oh, no, you know. And he also, I think, has a very high threshold for pain. And this is something that I learned about in the book, is that Kobe basically walked up to the line of dying right after he left the Justice Department in 2005.
Yes, he had a very, very serious bout of cancer.
And I think that for Comey, someone who sort of looked death in the eye, had stage 3 cancer, was hospitalized twice after it, once for an infection in his stomach, once for a blood clot that went to his lung, and, you know, someone who got his will in order and had to look death in the eye, I think that for him, he's like, well, I think baked into him is the idea, like, if I survive that, then I can survive Donald Trump as president. I'm not sure he's consciously, like, thinking that exact thing, but baked into who Jim Comey is the fact that he looked cancer in the eye and walked away a survivor. And I think that that idea is something I'd actually love to explore more just in general in people who survive something where they've walked up to the line of death and how that changes their ability or willingness to do things afterwards. Because it's like, well, if I survive that, then I could survive this.
So Pete Strzok, in his recent book, does not directly address the allegations that Bob Mueller had significantly slowed down in the course of running his investigation, but he does describe conversations with Mueller in which he sort of makes a point of describing Mueller as sharp and precise. You portray it differently. Talk about your reporting about Bob Mueller.
So what I lay out in the book is basically struggles that Mueller had in prep sessions for his testimony and how there were real struggles to basically recall basic facts about the investigation. And the pursuit that I had of trying to report that and the walls that I ran into and the denials that I received. And in the end, Mueller testifies, and I think Mueller's testimony sort of spoke for itself. And if you talk to anyone who knew Mueller, that was a different person who was testifying. That was not the person of the FBI years. Now, there's a myriad of reasons why that, you know, someone would present that way, including normal aging. But I thought that Mueller's acuity and personality were fair game to write about, because I believed, based on looking at previous special counsels and people in similar positions, that the personality of that person is almost as significant as the underlying evidence. Because if that person is like Ken Starr or Lawrence Walsh, then I think you end up in a different place than someone who may be in their last job or may not be as sharp as they were a few decades earlier. And I think that who that person is has such a direct impact on things. Look, the decision not to make a decision on obstruction, I think is a good example of that. Of had it been, pick your former Justice Department official, you know, at one point it looked like Rosenstein was considering, albeit briefly, Jim Cole. Would Jim Cole, if he ran special counsel's office, have declined to make a decision on obstruction? And I think anything that can illuminate what Mueller was like and what his personality and being and acuity were, I think are essential to the moment, because his decisions, the decision not to make a decision, is hugely impactful on what happens with Trump and the consequences he does or does not face and how Barr was able to come in and clear the president.
So there's been a bit of a controversy following the news stories that emanated from your reporting on the book, specifically about the what I have termed the counterintelligence gap, which is, you know, this issue that the Mueller investigation did not conduct the counterintelligence investigation that everybody, including me, expected it was going to engage in. You posit a really interesting answer to the question of why, which is basically that Rod Rosenstein prevented it. There has been some pushback against that from people involved, including from Andy Weissman, one of Mueller's deputies. On the other hand, Andy McCabe, the deputy FBI director or the acting FBI director at the time, has said, you know, he was pretty surprised that Mueller had not done that stuff and had proceeded on the assumption that Mueller was handling the counterintelligence equities as well as the criminal equities. You know, I'm curious for your sense of the controversy in light of both the reporting that you did and also some of the pushback that the reporting has received.
The place that the reporting starts on this is with Mueller's testimony on the day of the hearing when he goes up to the Hill. And he basically says that they did not do this inquiry into Trump's longstanding financial ties to Russia. And in the process of reporting the book, what I'm able to figure out is that McCabe opens this investigation. Rosenstein is taken aback by it. McCabe has done it unilaterally. And McCabe is pushing Rosenstein to appoint a special counsel and thinks that if they need this special counsel to conduct this sort of once in a generation investigation into the president's personal and financial ties to Russia, to totally understand that and whether he's compromised. And Rosenstein, in that process, appoints Mueller. But when Rosenstein goes to task Mueller, he says, go conduct a criminal investigation. If you want to do more, you can come back to me. But the simple directing of Mueller to conduct the criminal investigation is directing them off of what McCabe had opened. And what Rosenstein doesn't do is he doesn't go back and tell McCabe how he has directed Mueller, giving McCabe the impression that Mueller has inherited this whole thing and will conduct it. And McCabe believed that Mueller was conducting it until you know, I basically sort of laid out to him the series of events that went on here.
And do you have the sense that Rosenstein did that by way of hoodwinking McCabe, as in, was he being actively, I don't want to say deceitful, but sort of hiding the ball about what he did? Or was it simply, I mean, the truth is that Mueller's investigative mandate was public and was, you know, pretty clearly, actually in retrospect at least, pretty clearly a criminal investigation. And what's more, the special counsel regs by their terms contemplate a criminal investigation. And so, I mean, do you have the sense that this was a kind of bit of deceptiveness on Rosenstein's part? Or do you have a sense that it was just kind of McCabe thought one thing was happening and Rosenstein kind of directed something else and word never really got back to McCabe?
So I think the point here that illuminates this is that the appointment of Mueller had as much to do about getting the investigation away from McCabe as it did about insulating it from Trump. Because I think Rosenstein thought that McCabe may have conflicts and that they may be out of control in opening up this investigation, and that he wanted someone with clearer eyes to take a look at it and to get the investigation away from McCabe. And there was only so many ways you could cut the FBI out of such an investigation. This was not like a case where you could bring the DEA in to do the work of such a complicated investigation. And the move to appoint Mueller is to get it away from McCabe, among the reasons. And the thing is that was a motivating factor for Rosenstein, and he never goes back to McCabe to basically explain to him the way that he has tasked Mueller. Now you ask, well, shouldn't McCabe have realized this? And I think the sense from McCabe was that Rosenstein never raised objections to him about the opening of the counterintelligence investigation. When they briefed Congress on this and they told Congress, McCabe says, look, we've opened this two-pronged investigation, obstruction and counterintelligence. Rosenstein doesn't stand up and say, you know, hold on, wait a minute. And this all leaves McCabe with the impression that Mueller is going to pick up where the FBI has opened and left off.
The book is Donald Trump versus the United States, Inside the Struggle to Stop a President. The author is Mike Schmidt of the New York Times. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode was Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. You should do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Tweet about it, share it on Facebook, upvote it on Reddit, and pin it on Pinterest. You can get your Lawfare merch at thelawfarestore.com. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.